Welcome, 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 beloved listeners to LNL. A little later in the program, I'll be reintroducing you to Professor Norman Davies, who my old friend Barry Owen Jones thinks is even more than a polymath than he is. And Norman will be continuing his discussions with us on matters historical. And from the historical to what I thought was hysterical, the Prime Minister's announcement of a rejigged honours system. And, you know, I've been making light of it, as have most people. But Barry Jones, the aforementioned, who's received more honours than most of us have had hot breakfast and is therefore an expert on honours, sees it rather differently. And I've invited Barry in. He's actually sitting in Melbourne while I'm in the studio in Sydney, to tell us why this is such a brilliant decision.
Well, there's a certain reinforcement about it all. Now, we're not alone in awarding dameships and knighthoods. Now, apart from Great Britain, New Zealand, and now Australia, knighthoods and dameships are still awarded in the following countries: Antigua and Barbados, Belize, Dominica, the Turks and Caicos Islands, St. Christopher and Nevis, St. Vincent and Grenadines, St. Lucia, the Solomon Islands, and Tuvalu.
Wow.
Now, don't you feel better?
I do. I feel much more confident.
Now, since 2004, Papua New Guinea, which used to be rather lavish in the award of imperial honours, now has its own system, and recipients of the highest order are known as Grand Chiefs.
Oh, even better. Is it too late?
Now, I find it very curious, very interesting, that when John Howard was Prime Minister, he made no attempt, as far as is known, to revive knighthoods, dameships, or even membership of the Privy Council. And so in this case, it's interesting that Tony Abbott has streaked far ahead, or, depending on your point of view, streaked far behind his mentor. Now, since the right of nomination is to be exercised by the Prime Minister and not to be operated in the way in which you have an independent council which recommends the honours to the Governor-General, it means that somebody seeking a recommendation might well be advised not to cross him. Now, the other thing that struck me...
Hang on, I'm just taking notes here. Do not cross the Prime Minister. Thanks, I got that right.
Now, look, but yesterday's decision also raises some interesting speculation about what will happen in the States. You'll remember that in the olden days, we were just old enough to remember, that the States, for example, used to have the right to nominate knighthoods of their own, and it was not for nothing that Brisbane was known in the Joe Jilkey Peterson era as the City of Dreadful Knights. And the question now is, does the Prime Minister have a monopoly on the capacity to recommend people for knighthoods, or are state premiers going to have a go? I'd be very interested to know whether the state premiers have been consulted on this. I've got a kind of hunch that they didn't. And I'd imagine, say, that if you'd been talking to Campbell Newman on one hand and, say, Barry O'Farrell on the other hand, you might have got two completely different kind of responses.
OK. Malcolm Fraser's a pretty close mate of yours. I think it's fair to say that you've been talking to him about it too.
I don't talk about private conversations, even those with yours. But let me just say that when he was Prime Minister, Malcolm Fraser did institute, or rather revived, exactly as Tony Abbott has now, revived the appointments of dames and knights. And it's since Malcolm has firmly joined the Republican cause, to the horror of many of his former associates, I think it would be fair to say, and I choose my words carefully, that if he'd had his time all over again, he wouldn't have done it, and I think he would regard it as a bit of an error of judgment that he did it. But it goes back to this whole system of the on-again, off-again honours system, about whether a particular kind of honours, particular kind of system depends on which individual is prime minister at any given time. Now, that's a concept which may not charm Buckingham Palace, because what I do remember very vividly is back in 1984, when Bob Hawke was prime minister and they overturned the earlier decision about appointing or recommending the knighthoods and dameships. At that point, there was a rather an oblique, but I thought telling, kind of comment from Buckingham Palace, which said the palace let it be known that it hoped that the Australian honours system was now settled, in inverted commas, because it had been uncomfortable about the system, the operation of the system being dependent on which party was in office in a state, territory or national, or indeed nationally.
Now that message from the palace was echoed in the private conversations you had with HM, but you won't divulge those, will you?
I never divulge conversation with the monarch. What concerns me is, of course, it really revives all those issues, those what seemed to be long-dead issues from the time of the constitutional referendum of 1999, when, as you remember, Tony Abbott was a kind of a general in charge, in a way, a master strategist on the monarchist side. But there's a kind of an implicit assumption in the way in which the Prime Minister thinks about the Constitution, and that is that in a way, that back in the 1890s, our founding fathers, not our founding mothers, of course, except in Western Australia and South Australia, that our founding fathers really scored a kind of political hole in one. You know, that they had absolutely no idea about federation. They'd never been involved in the federation. They had no experience on it. But strangely, with the one vote, they got it absolutely right. And that we, poor creatures, in 2014, although Australia's had, you know, 113 years of experience of the federal system, that our judgment, our knowledge, our experience, our understanding somehow would not be superior to the understanding of our great-great-grandparents. That's right, great-great-grandfathers, sorry, and mothers in a couple of states. So I think it's related too to a kind of an underlying lack of faith in the robustness of our institutions, that if we tried something new, you know, we'd muck it up. And I think in the case of the Australian honours system, he thinks we've mucked it up. And, well, if we've got a problem, we can always go back to mother. I think if he thinks that way, as I suspect he does, I think it reflects a massive failure of historical understanding of how terrific Australian colonies were in the 19th century.
Well, we saw women getting the vote, we saw secret ballots, a whole lot of areas in which we were cutting edge.
We were decades, absolutely, we were decades ahead. And even the acceptance of the term democratic, which in England was regarded as pretty shocking. You know, Lord Salisbury, the Prime Minister, when Queen Victoria died, when the Commonwealth was set up, recoiled at the use of the word democratic and said, oh, no, he could never be accused of being democratic. It was seen as an abusive word. But so the timing, I think, of this announcement, of course,
many of us see it as what conjurers do, misdirection, when you're pulling off your trick.
Well, it's very curious that it coincides. First, it coincides with those significant amendments of the Racial Discrimination Act that are being proposed, and of course the Attorney General's explicit defence of bigotry. But the second thing, I think, it gives a bit of biffo to multiculturalism, and I think there's the strong sense that the implicit values in his own experience are that the British heritage comes first, and I think that's modified by his own Catholic heritage. And all other values in our multicultural society, all other values fall a long way back. And I think it's a very interesting analysis in sociology to reflect that if you went back to the Menzies era, only a few decades back, at that stage, the Catholics were very much on the outer. You had a cabinet which was, of course, totally male, and you had people, majority of whom were Freemasons, and that kind of groups, which Freemason was then very important, had an absolutely dominant but quite unexamined role in Australia, and Catholics were seen on the outer. And there were Catholic ministers like Neil O'Sullivan and later on Phil Lynch.
Yeah.
But there were very few of them.
Yeah.
They were very much on the outer. So it's very striking how much change there's been. And I think it's very healthy that religious groups are not fixed.
Barry, I've got to warn you not to get on the wrong side of the Prime Minister, otherwise you'll never get your knighthood, and that's the only gong you haven't got. Look, mate, thank you very much for that. Barry Jones, AO, making a fascinating contribution to the Little Wireless program. Coming up, someone that Barry admires enormously, as do I, Professor Norman Davies. Okay, as lauded by Barry Jones, Professor Norman Davies, author and historian extraordinaire, is sitting opposite me. And the question that he's put to himself over the years is, where do you begin with a subject like the history of Europe? In what year? Which country? He writes not just about the Europe we all learn about, Spain, Italy, France, England, but also the non-mainstream lands of East and Central Europe. And he brings to historical narrative a rare poetic flair, a love of storytelling, and an eye for iconoclastic details. His books include Europe a History and The Isles a History, and he spoke to us about that back in 2000, and also Vanished Kingdoms, the history of half-forgotten Europe. It's a wonderful account of nation-states which blossomed for short periods and then died. He's currently in Australia as a guest of the Australian Institute of Polish Affairs, and he's a visiting fellow at the University of Tasmania. Norman, welcome back. And to give people a sense of how fascinating you can be, would you just repeat to me what you said off air about the founding of Glasgow?
Well, Glasgow was founded by the, the ancient Welsh, ancient British, before the Scots came to Scotland. Glasgow in Welsh means blue meadow, and it came into being, I think, in the 6th century. St. Mungo, who also has a Welsh name, and not many people in Glasgow know about it. I went to Dumbarton Rock, which is was the capital of this ancient British kingdom, when the Roman legions left, and in the museum there I was asking difficult questions, but I realised they didn't know that this was the capital of a Welsh or ancient British kingdom.
I don't think they'd want to know, actually. You probably pissed them
off. Well, the lady was there, got about, stop asking me these questions because I'm a Pict.
Dear. Look, before we get stuck into the book, personal history. As you write in the introduction to Vanished Kingdoms, you were born, quote, a subject of the British Empire, a carefully chosen phrase.
That's right, but that's what we were taught we were, and it was written in our passports. It's not one of the things you choose to be. But in that paragraph, I said, not just a subject of the king emperor, as it was, but of the empire. And I think the book starts with this recollection of having been led up the garden path that the British Empire was eternal, and then, of course, it started falling to pieces pretty quickly.
You're fascinated by British chauvinism from your youth. Did you feel Welsh growing up in Lancashire?
I did, oddly enough, and it's, as it were, one element of my identity. I have a very Welsh name. For some reason, I never found out my father, when he registered my birth, put the Welsh name Ivor before Norman. Yes, I think with a name like Davies and being a bit contrary to things, I adopted a Welsh identity from being a boy. I was taken to Wales many times, to Welsh-speaking Wales. That's where I learned that there were people in the world that didn't speak English. And I picked it up. I can even remember the moment when I decided I was Welsh.
Please tell me.
My grandfather was a Welsh-speaking Welshman. He persecuted his children, i.e. my father and my father's siblings, made them sing Welsh hymns before breakfast or they didn't get any food. So my father was very much against this Welshness. But I, in due turn, rebelled against my father. And at the age of 7 or 8, he took us to Wales, and I saw a Welsh language newspaper on a rack on the street. And I said to my father, you know, what's this? And he said, oh, it's not interesting, you know, don't not for you. So, of course, I went and bought it and pretended I could read it. And I then decided I was going to belong to this nation that didn't speak English.
An old friend of mine, sadly deceased, was a Manning Clark, who was trying to define what Australia was about,
and yes,
he had the audacity to write poetically, which got him in, still gets him into trouble even long after his death. I've already made that accusation that you write poetically. What I didn't realise was that you were inspired by Donny Davies, a football player.
Yes, I don't know whether he was known in Australia. He was very famous, Mancunian, Bolton in Mancunian. He was a broadcaster like yourself. He had a weekly program. He appeared, he was a footballer and then a journalist, wrote for the Manchester Guardian, and he was killed in the Munich air disaster. So, and he was a big influence in my life. He...
I understand that he would toss in quotes from the Bible when he was writing about sport and ancient history, classical text.
Oh yes, his column in the Guardian it was mixed in with, you know, opera and novels and analogies of high culture. There's another journalist who worked with him who was in some way, he was a bit older, his master, Neville Cardus, who wrote about cricket, but wrote about cricket and music at the same time. So a cricket match came out like a symphony, and my uncle's description of football matches were a bit like that.
You weren't originally going to be an historian. You went to Oxford. You plan to take up geography.
Mm-hmm.
Was there another eureka moment when you changed your mind?
Well, there was. I just didn't like the smell of the geography school on the first day I went there. I've no idea, but it's just one of those instinctive reactions.
You're not serious. It wasn't the smell.
Well, I think, yes, I think they'd been cleaning the hallway with some sort of powerful detergent. And, it was just the hesitations of youth. But I went back to Magdalen College, where A.J.P. Taylor was the tutor. And
should remind the listener that he was, of course, an historical superstar and the author of some of the most widely read books on European history to date.
Absolutely, and that I became a pupil of A.J.P. Taylor, and he encouraged me, so it was a fortunate accident.
But he also gave you a rather blasphemous view in that he talked about the need to be broad in scope as an historian. And that's not very fashionable these days, is it? It's another criticism that Manning Clark copped.
Yeah.
Too broad. How too dare broad. You?
As time has gone on, I think the ultra-specialists have been taking over. I think those of us who try to paint the broad picture are fewer and fewer. But certainly I picked that up from Taylor, and I think from several English historians. There has been, you know, ever since Edward Gibbon, a tradition of history as literature, as fine writing. And I think we were criticised more strongly for writing badly than getting our facts wrong.
But you in effect, feel that narrowness in focus is damaging to history, don't you? That historians become so specialised that they don't have a breadth of scope or a depth of understanding.
That certainly is the prevailing sin, I think, of the modern generation who have got so much data piling into them these days that their focus is narrower and narrower. But I must say that there are several very good specialists who write jewel-like stuff.
I love having them on. They can be absolutely astonishing, but I'm still sympathetic to the Taylor view, your view too, that it's good to be comprehensive, because I think that breadth of scope also does lead to depth.
Well, I think the big picture is what's been suffering. You know, I wrote this book on the Second World War, and several of my colleagues have tried to do the same, and it's quite obvious that the Second World War has not been... there's no consensus about what happened. There's something like 30,000 books on it.
There's not even consensus on the Great War. That's still being hotly debated.
That's the latest one, yes.
Yeah.
There's a great need, I think, for people to put the work of specialists together and paint the broad panorama.
Would a young historian get that advice from at Oxford or Cambridge or any other major university?
Oh, I think so. Oxford and Cambridge are a very varied. You know, there's 40 colleges. There's 100 historians in each place. So they among them, you get a great variety of viewpoints. That's the great thing about those about Oxford is that they argue with each other all the time, and that there isn't a one school of history. And
this is Ellie Nell on RN, and I'm talking to historian, author, and poetic historian Professor Norman Davies is visiting us as a guest at the Australian Institute of Polish Affairs. We'll get on to Poland a little later. And visiting fellow at the University of Tasmania. You've often said that it's important to remind people, particularly students of history, about transience, the transience of power, political orders, nation states, whole kingdoms.
Yes, I think there's a very strong tendency for historians to write about the roots of the present. They have a mental map of the present world, and there's a country called Australia, so people will write the history of Australia. There's a country called whatever, Indonesia, and people will write that. The past has a danger of becoming just an antiquated form of the present-day world, i.e. people dressed up in different clothes, but it's... different fashions, different ideas circulating, but essentially an old version of what exists today. But the reality is that the world is constantly changing, and you don't have to go very far back for the world to have been very different indeed.
One's reminded of this transience if you're watching the flag bearers at any Olympic Games. Suddenly there are new flags, familiar flags have disappeared. But people are so obsessed with now, they're almost blind to those changes.
Yeah, it's a sort of projection of the now into the past. And that's why I wrote this vanished kingdoms to show that there were mighty empires, civilizations, which no longer exist. They're extinct. But in their day, they could be very important.
Let's talk about what drew you to European history, in particular to Central and Eastern Europe.
Well, what drew me was going there as a teenager to begin with, first to Yugoslavia and then to places further east.
We're talking late 50s, early 60s.
Late 50s, early 60s. The Iron Curtain was very firmly in place. It was quite an adventure. It was only about 1,000 miles from London to go to Warsaw. It's not the other end of the earth, but it was a closed planet. It was a different world. And the adventure of youth took me there.
Is it true that adventure actually got you picked up and hungry and drugged while your vehicle and belongings were searched by...
I think that's not a fair, not an unfair summary. We certainly, for lads, we bought an ex-American Army Jeep for £30, and it still had US Army painted on the side, and we drove through the Iron Curtain with it. Well,
so you were misidentified by the vehicle, yes?
I think that's true, yes, yes. But we were certainly stopped. We were taken by some gentlemen in long trench coats to drink to the health of Manchester, I remember, and we passed out completely. So they put something in our
A few beer. Years later, the aforementioned Barry Jones and I were in in Prague, and it was the anniversary of Jan Palach's self-immolation, and the local power station had been sabotaged for the night. And Barry and I were misidentified because we'd just been to Moscow when we were dressed with Russian clobber. So we were beaten up. We were beaten up in Wenceslas Square by very annoyed Czechs. You've got to be careful about what you wear and what you drive.
And what you speak, yes. I once arrived in Warsaw when I spoke better Russian than I could speak Polish and made the mistake of asking a taxi man in Russian. He didn't blink an eye. He just drove me mile after mile through the snow and left me, beyond the tram tracks and said, "This is where you're going, sir." And so, yes, one learns lessons.
European history was at one time very much dominated by the stories of Western Europe. And you said once that after the collapse of the Soviet, people were ringing to ask you, what are these places like Lithuania and Ukraine?
Yeah, that's very true. In the early 90s, the ordinary journalists, they'd all been told that this was Russia. The plague, people thought the Soviet Union was Russia. Only 50% of the Soviet Union was Russia. But in the popular mind, all the captive nations had sunk from view. Fortunately, I think the awareness today is rather better. I think most people realise that Ukraine is different than Russia. It's in the newspapers every day. And although I don't think people are very clear about its history, they have cottoned on to, this is a different place.
Let's look at your relationships with Poland. The book that brought you fame and also controversy was Poland, God's Playground. Now, you're married to a Polish woman. Mm. You divide your life between Poland and England. And you once wrote about Poland... Thus, its faded glories have been in the thick of European affairs for 1,000 years, and its blood-soaked fate in the 20th century provides an indispensable guide to decisive conflicts. But it's not in the mainstream. End of quote. Not in the mainstream.
Absolutely. I probably wrote that 25 or 30 years ago, and I've been trying to rectify the fact that the... Many general histories of Europe didn't mention Poland at all. They mention
things. I find that
well. They would mention, for example, that the Second World War broke out over Poland, but they wouldn't tell you anything about Poland. It was just a battlefield of the powers, and that could be that attitude was rife. That there was no real interest in the history, the culture, the languages of these historic nations.
Apart from your own efforts to put Poland back in the spotlight, has there been a revival of interest?
Definitely. I think Poland is now an established member of the European Union. Poland is no longer just the object of other people's politics. Polish transition has been quite successful. Thousands and thousands. I worked out 1,000 British people visit Krakow every day. Five planes go to Krakow every day.
I've been on one of them. So, yeah.
The general awareness is 100 times greater now than it was 25 years ago.
But even now, the focus is still on the Third Reich, isn't it? And that annoys you. You've complained about this.
Well, don't expect me to speak up for the Third Reich. What I'm always going for is the whole picture. I think there's something you can call the Allied version of history, that we tend to view history through the priorities of our own experience. So the Third Reich was our enemy, and this is the embodiment of evil and shouldn't be compared to anything else. If you look at this period from the Eastern European perspective, you're dealing with people who had the Third Reich on their back, but also Stalin's Soviet Union, and they suffered from both sides. I think it's necessary, obviously, to talk about the Third Reich and all its evil, but equally to put that in the context of the time.
You did, in an article for the New York Review of Books, say happy will be the day when reviewers are asked to comment on something else.
When me, I said happy will the day when this reviewer is asked to write about something else.
Yeah. It can be very difficult to introduce new narratives, can't you? And you found this when the otherwise widely praised Poland, God's Playground, came under fire by some academics in the 80s. Now, your book contends that in pre-war Poland, Jews faced discrimination, but so did many other ethnic and social groups. And you also say that the idea that Poles collectively rejoiced over the fate of Jews is just not accurate. Now, this made you a target for people who dubbed you as an anti-Semite, and also seems to have cost you an academic post at Stanford.
I think that's accurate, yes. It wasn't so much that I had said things they didn't like. It was that I didn't say what they wanted me to say, namely that they wanted a generalised smear that Poland is an anti-Semitic country and that anti-Semitism was a major feature of Polish life before the war, which I don't think it was. That's why I suffered.
What happened at Stanford, or what didn't happen at Stanford?
Well, unknown individuals protested against my having been accepted for an endowed chair. I'd been through all the procedures, the search committees and whatnot. And the decision of the search committee was reversed without appeal and without me ever being told about it.
We did a lengthy program on Hannah Arendt the other night, and
right, there's a new film about it. Yes,
terrific film, yeah. I think. But of course, what you were describing would have been familiar to
absolutely
her.
A fellow spirit in some ways.
Yeah, well, you are a contrarian, aren't you? But you made the point that the Nazi occupation force terrorised all Poles.
Yes, the Nazis had a calibrated list of racial categories. The Jews were obviously at the bottom of the victims, the bottom of the list or the top of the list, the worst. They were slated for extermination, but all the others were slated for maltreatment of various sorts, and quite large numbers of Poles were categorized for extermination. You know, my Polish father-in-law was picked up in October 39, sent to Dachau. He wasn't Jewish, but he was in the category of educated Poles who were to be wiped out. And, of course, at the end of the war, he is a strong man. He survived Mauthausen, Dachau, comes back in 1945, and he's picked up by Stalin's NKVD for having survived Dachau. And his maltreatment at their hands was just as bad as Dachau and Mauthausen.
I used to go to Poland quite a lot, a place I absolutely loved and found haunting in every possible way. Mm. But I must say, in the early 70s, there was still a very high level of anti-Semitism in Poland.
In some quarters, of course, the focus of it was in the Communist Party. There was this purge in the late 60s where the Communist Party purged the Jewish element. A large number of people who stayed in Poland after 1948, Jewish people, were connected in one way or another with the communist state. They were purged, and sure, there was, I would think that's the last big wave of Polish anti-Semitism. And it was an ugly episode.
You spent a lot of time in Poland. How do the Poles now feel about that time in their history? I mean, is Auschwitz just down the road?
Yeah, I think a lot of them have moved on. I think one of the good things in recent times that Poles have been liberated from their awful history in many ways. They've got things to look forward to. It is curious, but the fear of Russia has remained, whereas the fear of Germany has evaporated. This is because the Germans themselves have changed radically. Hundreds of thousands of Poles go to Germany all the time, live there, and that problem has finished, whereas the Russian problem continues. And I've no doubt, I've not been in Poland for a couple of months, but the Ukrainian business is obviously playing badly in Poland. A lot of Poles are frightened about what might happen.
I want to come back to Russia, Crimea, shortly, but first of all, let's backtrack a bit back to vanished kingdoms and this idea of transience, of, you know, this almost brigadoon quality that so many quite amazingly powerful places have suffered. Just talk about some of those historically. The places that have vanished.
Vanished. You did say as it were, these vanished kingdoms existed for a brief time, for a day. Some of them were extremely long-lived. You know, the kingdom of the Crown of Aragon, which starts in the Iberian Peninsula, they got as far as Athens. Can you know, the whole of the Mediterranean for a time in the 15th century was under the, if not the direct control, certainly the galleys of Aragon were everywhere. That's almost been forgotten because Aragon lost out to Castile, and the Spanish story is usually told through the, you know, the eyes of Madrid. But this was an empire of before the Castilians went to America, and of course that was a game changer. The Aragonese were extremely powerful.
One of the things in my very eclectic collection, there's a wedding portrait of King Henry of Navarre, you know, and this was taken around at the time. That was a substantial society.
Absolutely.
Which vanished, didn't it?
But again, it wasn't a flash in the pan. We're talking about centuries. Navarre was eventually divided between France and Spain, but had a long period of an independent, vigorous existence. I was actually in two minds whether to do a chapter on Navarre or Aragon, but I chose Aragon. But there's lots of them, you know, the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, going back to Ukraine. But the whole of Ukraine spent nearly three centuries in the Grand Duchy of Lithuania, long before it had any connection with Russia. And this was probably the largest state on the European map for quite a long time. It's not a, you know, funny little place was here one day and gone the next. It was a major power for a long period of time, completely evaporated, in nothing like the Republic of Lithuania today.
Well, of course, in our lifetime, we've seen the evaporation of Czechoslovakia, for example.
Indeed,
haven't we? Yes. The Velvet Divorce, yes, but it's there, and then suddenly it ain't.
But the biggest one is the Soviet Union. That was the last chapter in the book. This, I think, was the...
You're not alone in saying we didn't see it coming.
Absolutely. I can claim that I said in 1987 that if they don't watch, if Gorbachev doesn't get his act together, then it's conceivable that this enormous state could fall apart. That's when the war broke out between Azerbaijan and Armenia, and amazingly, he, against all the Soviet rules, he allowed it to go on.
I spent a weekend with Gorby in Brisbane when he came out to a discussion, and we talked for an hour on glasnost, perestroika, and the disintegration of his beloved USSR. He didn't see it coming either.
He was trying to save it.
Yeah. And he broke it.
Poor chap, yes. Well, I suppose we ought to thank him, because if he had known what he was doing a bit better, we might still be lumbered with the Soviet Union. But Putin is doing his best to put it back together again.
Okay, well, the Soviet is inescapable. The former states like Crimea seemingly now want to return to the Russian motherland. Does that surprise you?
Oh, no, but the Crimea is a very artificial entity. It's a small peninsula. It's essentially a Russian naval base. You know, all these Russians there are largely military personnel and their dependents, and people brought in... Putin said the other day, Crimea has all been part of Russia. Well, sorry.
I'd forgotten that Khrushchev, in fact, gave it to Ukraine.
Yes.
Why did he do that?
He did that in 1954 because he was trying to create... The Russians were eternally persecuting the Ukrainians. They regarded the Ukrainians as their little brothers, but the Ukrainians wouldn't behave and so on. And there was a lot of disaffection in Ukraine after the war. Like the biggest losses in the Second World War were in Ukraine, not in Russia. And Khrushchev was trying to, recruit the sympathies of the Ukrainians. Dreamt up a centenary of the rebellion of Bogdan Khmelnytsky in 1654. Khmelnytsky, of course, was a Pole, not a Ukrainian, but that didn't bother them. And as part of this festival, Khrushchev had the wild idea of giving a chunk of the Russian Soviet Republic to the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. It didn't mean anything at the time, but obviously nobody was dreaming in 1954 of the possible disintegration of the Soviet Union.
You are no fan of communism, nor totalitarian states in general, but I would have thought you have a layered view on the question of where loyalties lie and mm-hmm. who should decide the fates of people.
Yes, I have a lot of sympathy for the Ukrainians. They're probably one of the most maltreated nations of Europe in the 20th century. Successive horrors and atrocities. What is really interesting to me now is that the great majority of Russian speakers in Ukraine are just as opposed to Putin and Putin's Russia as the Ukrainian speakers. It's not true that Eastern Ukraine is pro-Russian and Western Ukraine is opposed to the East. The Ukraine is much more complicated, and I think this present event, the consequences of the annexation of Crimea, will include a great strengthening of Ukraine identity. This may well be the moment where Ukrainian identity crystallizes, and you'll then have a nation which is capable of running a nation state.
I suddenly have a desire to change directions quite dramatically. Until atheism became popular, fashionable, as a result of the activities of my old friend Christopher Hitchens and mm-hmm. my unfriend Dawkins, I'm a much more amiable atheist than them. Mm-hmm. But I used to make the point that not only do nations disappear, but entire faiths evaporate.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just as intriguing to me as the death of nations. Think of all the theologies that have in fact gone to God or gone to their gods
right.
over a very long period, but it continues to happen, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. As it were, the faith in people's minds, i.e. belief in various either religions or ideologies and so on, is what drives political organisms. But those faiths fade and die like everything else.
Or evolve into others.
That's right. They transmogrify into strange variations and strange mergers and so on. But nothing is stable. Everything is on the move.
As a Welsh nonconformist, you would have been brought up with a considerable respect for Christianity.
Indeed, but not for the church, the established church. That's one of the features of nonconformity, that they didn't like bishops, they didn't like organized religion, they were very democratic, they elected their ministers or presbyters. So, yes, there's a big streak of contrariness in nonconformism.
Do you have faith now?
Sort of, yes, but I'm not a great admirer of churches and feel quite free to talk on that subject.
Do you perhaps murmur the occasional prayer when you climb onto an aircraft?
I certainly will. I thought of that today, yes, having yes, there's a residue of ideas and practices, and it's probably too much to say faith, but yes, I think that there is a residue of belief in me, yes.
Is there a residue of belief in you for European Union?
I think, again, the European Union has been in serious trouble through complacency and lack of direction. One thing that the Crimean crisis is going to do is put the European Union back on track. They're going to help Ukraine. They're thinking about cooperation in a way they didn't. I think David Cameron will forget his idea of renegotiating terms and so on. But at last, there's something more important than just the bread and butter of the Union. And
given that it was your mob that founded Glasgow, do you have a view on the other vote which is coming up on Scottish independence?
Well, I do. My son is working for a leading MP from Scotland. I think the result of the referendum depends a lot on the conduct of the British government in London. And
my daughter is in Edinburgh also working hard on this issue.
As things stand, I don't think it'll pass. But all it needs is the British government to go off on some anti-European crusade. I say I think Cameron's going to forget it, but if that happened, then the Scots are suddenly going to be encouraged. And they may well have a second or a third time.
The last thing I'm going to ask you about is, as empires come and crumble, what do you see ahead for such a modern-day... Well, for one specific modern-day kingdom, the US?
The US, well, the US is still very powerful. I feel that it has gone over the hill. But one thing from writing about all these vanished kingdoms, that very few of them end like the Soviet Union and go up in a puff of smoke. Most of them go down the slippery slope, go back a step, two steps down and so on over a long period of time. I think the USA has got quite a bit of life still in it.
But we're going to go up in a puff of smoke now, I'm afraid. But Professor Norman Davies, eminent historian of European history and author. He is in the colonies for a series of lectures. His next is this Thursday at the University of Western Sydney and Friday at the University of New South Wales. But for all the details, visit our website at abc.net.au/rn. This was Late Night Live. On our next, a portrait of modern-day Delhi. There's another vanishing kingdom, the Raj, described as a corrupt, violent and traumatised city growing so fast it's almost unrecognisable to its own inhabitants. Oh, plus the virtues of slothfulness, which is something that Norman knows absolutely nothing about. Please stick around for the news on RN, and I'll see you in 23 hours.